We've been fighting a long time, and we have all lost so very much, so many loved ones gone. But you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. You have no idea how important you are. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Ave Maria.
Welcome, everybody. It's that time of the year ago. No, it's not summer. Well, it's still summer. But no, it's what did Father actually say this season? Episode 4 or 5? I lost count after 1.
I think so, this is technically 3.
Is it 3?
Yeah, but we should probably be doing more. But, you know, my intention isn't to correct every little thing I see that people to say I'm saying is wrong. It's just some of them are a bit more egregious than others.
It gets to a boiling point. I mean, we're not going to be Fast and the Furious 10 by all means. I mean,
No, yeah, exactly.
So anyways, to start out with, Father, there's a new book of yours. I have a copy of it right here. Can you explain?
Yes, that's the book. It's called The Limits of Papal Authority Over the Liturgy. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason I wrote the thing is because people like Cardinal Burke and Bishop Ashton Nader Schneider would make statements about saying that the Pope didn't have that authority to do this or that. And I agree with them. The difficulty I was running up against, and it partly could just be my own not having read everything they had said, etc., but I just couldn't find anything where they talked about the actual principles that govern when you actually know what the Pope is saying, that whether you have to give consent to it or not regarding the liturgy. Or in other words, does he have, or more accurately, it would be to say, do I have to be obedient, and when, based upon what in Latin they call it ad rem, the thing over which he has the authority in relationship to the liturgy. Because there is, you actually see this, people who criticize some of my other writings saying that the Pope is infallible in all matters. Well, that's not even Catholic. In fact, that's heretical. The church itself has said, no, these are the boundaries under which the Pope can, we know for certain when he's infallible. Outside that context, he can be fallible, etc. Well, the same thing kind of applies in relationship to the liturgy, that there are certain restrictions regarding what he can and cannot do in relationship to the liturgy. One of the most common ones you always see hear people quote is quo primum. But in all the English translations I read, none of them were accurate that I saw to the actual Latin, because they were all putting it in more doctrinal language, whereas in the Latin, it's much more juridic language. Ryan Grant's also talked about this a little bit, and I've been trying to encourage him to actually do a translation of it, because it's more juridic language. But in the book, I point out that the issue isn't that the document's infallible because it's a juridic document. The issue is that there were principles that it states that are the undergirding doctrinal principles which determine when the Pope can and cannot make changes to the liturgy. And those are what's the most important. So it's not that the document's infallible, it's the principles that undergird it that become basically infallible if you take a close look at it. So that's just, but my basic gist was I wanted to write a book that would actually address the principles that govern when you can say the Pope is stepping outside his authority and when he's not. Because I think most people have a lot of traditionalists have a sense that there's something wrong. He's doing something. He shouldn't be able to do this. But we need to be very specific, especially in theological terms. So that's kind of the idea behind it. I'm going to frustrate people. It's not a book that you can buy publicly. It's only meant for theologians, bishops, and priests who are addressing this issue and trying to formulate the thing, because this is one of those books you put out so that people can begin the process of formulating the principles and get clarity about the principles. And then at a certain point, depending on how things go, I suppose that if the Holy Father were to try and suppress the old rite outright, I would just let it go and let the public have it and let them see it. But for right now, it's in a private run.
And I got one because I'm none of those, but I am a cool guy.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, part of it is just so she can be aware of actually what I'm doing, you know. And I mean, I can't talk. I have actually done some public speaking on it. I did a conference in Steubenville and also one in Phoenix recently on the principles. And you can basically boil them down to four principles that govern, that restrict the Holy Father or put limits on the Holy Father's authority in relationship to the liturgy. The first is that he can't put anything in there that's contrary to divine positive law or the natural law. So, for example, he could not promulgate a rite that would include something which was false, because that's against the natural law, right? So, and this is actually one of the reasons I actually did bring up in the book to talk about the fact that the real issue with the Promultes clause had nothing to do with validity. It had to do with the fact that you had the priest saying something materially false at the time of the consecration. That was what the real problem was, at least in my book. So that's one, or something contrary to the divine positive law. So he couldn't put in something in there where you would, although this is also against the natural law, where you engage in some type of pagan idol worship during the mass, right? That would be outside his authority to do. So the first one is he can't promulgate anything contrary to the divine positive law and natural law. The second one is one that the Council of Trent stated, that he has authority over the rituals of the mass, but the rituals except those salve illorum substantia, so except for those things which pertain to the substance of the sacraments, is how that's generally done. Now, what I do is I talk about that basically means that the Pope can't promulgate a rite that doesn't have valid words of consecration. And this actually became a bit of a problem with the canon, which I also talk about in the book, the canon of Ad Imari, which is a serious issue, where you basically have a canon of the mass that has no words of consecration. And I go into theologically why that's a problem. But the Council of Trent restricts him so he can't touch the substance of the sacrament, so he can't change the matter and form of the mass, for example. He also can't, but later, so in the initial, when this first came out, the theologians thought that was just restricted only to the matter and form of mass. But later theologians began taking a look at it. And so for about the last 150 years, some of them have broadened it to those things which pertain not just to the substance of the sacraments, but just to the substance of the rituals in general. So, for example, the Pope could not promulgate a rite that did not have a proper offertory, right? Or he couldn't promulgate a rite that didn't have the communion of the priest, because the offertory, the canon, and the communion of the priest are an integral part of Mass. So he couldn't promulgate a rite that didn't have one of those. And that becomes a particular thorny issue, because some of the theologians, as I would point out, I don't point this out in the book because I just leave it alone, but some of the theologians historically have talked about the fact that even Benedict, Pope Benedict himself, said that there were issues with the new rite of the offertory and the new rite. So there were issues like that. Okay, so the first is, so the divine positive law of natural law, the substance of the sacraments. The third is what they call the principle of apostolicity. And that's broken down into three parts. The first is if it comes from divine tradition. So Christ said, do this in commemoration of me. That means that once Christ commanded it, no pope has the authority to make change to what Christ commanded. So divine tradition is binding across the board, and no pope can change anything that's part of divine tradition. Christ then also told the apostles to insert certain things into the Mass. So one of the things is that one of the fathers, that Christ actually commanded the apostles to put a preface in the Mass. So a Pope, technically speaking, couldn't promulgate a rite without a preface, because that's a divino apostolic tradition. And then the last is apostolic tradition. And all of the fathers in the early church say if something is of apostolic tradition, so in other words, if it's been in the liturgy from the time of the apostles on, then the Pope doesn't have any authority to change that particular element of the liturgy. So that's one of the other the things that he can't change. So if it has the quality of apostolicity, then he can't change it. This becomes extraordinarily important, because most people don't realize that it was actually that principle of apostolicity became the principle by which Pius V set a cutoff date, because it's before that you could demonstrate the apostolicity of the elements in most of those liturgies. The rest after that you couldn't, because there was too many changes and adoptions that had been done. So that becomes a very important point with that. It also becomes a key issue in Quo Primum, and it becomes the undergirding principle there. And then the last one, which I talk about, which theologians talk about, they don't talk a whole lot about it, that which is called the principle of longevity. So the longer something is in the liturgy, the more it's the will of God that it be there. And the general, the kind of the general cutoff is 200 to 400 years around in there, again, basing it on Pius V's suppression of the rites, because only two popes have suppressed rites, Gregory VII and Pius V. So that that 200-year cutoff, so if something's been in the liturgy for more than 200 years, although I would probably personally think it would be a little bit better than 400, but if it's been in the liturgy for that long, then it demonstrates that God, because over the course of time, he moves the church to weed out the problems in the liturgy, and it takes time, about 100 to 150 years, very often on average. So, but that means after 200 to 400 years, that means if something's been in there longer than that, that's an indicator that God has allowed it to remain in the liturgy, and that it's his part of his positive will that it remain there. And so if something's been in the liturgy for that length of time, then the subsequent popes very often consider themselves as, I don't have the authority to change that. And so this those kind of became the principles which I discovered in the course of the research for this book. So that gives people kind of a general idea of what's in the book.
Isn't it, was it your book or was it somewhere else that I read about the 200-year thing? Wasn't that because... he didn't want to suppress the Dominican rite, and it was within.
Yeah, there. Well, that's Ryan Grant's assertion, and actually, Ryan does get that from other theologians, and I think there's a certain truth in that. But the fact of the matter is, though, is that the Dominican rite, the elements in the ancient Dominican rite, do have apostolicity. They meet that they do have that quality. They meet those requirements, and so. Someone said, oh, he just didn't want to cut that off. Well, I mean, that could have been the personal motive, but the actual theological undergirding, especially when you read it in Quo Primum, is that it has to do with the apostolicity. The ones after that, that were up to 200 years, there was all sorts of liturgical modifications that were being made in the Middle Ages, and though that's what they got cut off, because many of those liturgical changes did not have, couldn't demonstrate the quality of apostolicity. They couldn't trace themselves back to an apostle. That particular element couldn't be demonstrated to go back to any particular apostle. And so this is one of the reasons why the cutoff was there. So even though I mean, 200 years, maybe, but I think that that's the Dominican rite, I think, can demonstrate those elements.
You used the P word a couple of times in their prudence. I remember Michael Davies in a couple of talks saying that he has the authority, but probably wasn't prudent to do something. So you bring up
that's actually. Yeah, in fact, that was one of the things that I addressed extensively, because that the first person that I could come across of that actually asserted that was Congar, actually. He said that, you know, the Pope, could he basically substantially modify or suppress the old rite? And his basic answer is, yeah, but it wouldn't be prudent. And my basic point in this book is to show, no, there's certain principles that show that he can't do that. There's certain restrictions on his authority. The prudence question is a completely different set of questions, which everyone says it's a prudential question. So that's why the longest chapter in the book is on prudence, because I go through literally every single aspect of prudence, every single sub-virtue of prudence, and show that in the last 50 years, the liturgical changes did not meet a single requirement of prudence. So this is one of the things that at least based on the arguments that I think could legitimately be proffered. So that's one of the reasons why that's such a long part of the chapter, or some part of the book.
And it's good for the history for people to come out there so that people just doesn't lose their minds, can calm down a little bit, be at peace, and stop the, I don't know, anger online, I guess, too.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things is too. There's two things. I wanted to know the principles, because it's not enough for me just to think it. I need to know the principles behind it, so that for the primary reason of, if something comes down from the Vatican that is just crazy, I should say, if something more comes down from the Vatican that's crazy, I don't I want to know the principles so that I can have clarity of conscience in the matter. Because one of the biggest mistakes people make, and this is actually something that they used against many priests, abusing many priests, is telling them, oh, you have to go off to this ecclesiastical gulag and get psychiatrically destroyed in order for you, because there's something psychologically wrong with you because you believe in the Catholic faith, basically, is what was being said. And so the guys thought in obedience they had to do it when, no, the bishop had no authority whatsoever to tell them to do that, right? So, and this is something which the prudential thing has been, and knowing the principles is something that's really key, so that if something comes down from the Vatican, you can have clarity of conscience, knowing, okay, and in judgment, this is what he can and cannot change.
As well footnoted, none of this is Fowler's opinion. He cited his sources very well in here, and there's quite a few of them.
Yeah, I was very careful because this is something, and it's the other thing is that some of the guys that have read it got a little frustrated because I didn't draw a whole lot of conclusions. You know, because they're like, oh, well, you should have said this about the new mass and that about the new mass. I'm like, that's not what my point was. Mm-hmm. My point was just to parse out, because we keep hearing the rumors and rumors of rumors coming out of the Vatican about liturgical changes and this and that. And I just said, I just need to know the principles that govern this thing. And so that's why I put it together. There has been some pretty high level guys at theologians that have already read the thing. There's now more that are actually reading it. But I'm restricting who can actually read the book, only because of the fact that if I put it out there, you're going to just get a lot of hacks who are just going to go ballistic, and it's just going to get lost in the fray. I want this to be something that the theologians can take a good look at it and then see, you know, as St. Paul says, you know, test what is good and throw out what's bad, but just make sure that the reasoning process and everything is sound in it.
Fantastic. Let's get to what everybody tuned in for. They don't care about this.
Yeah,
this is not a topic no everybody really cares about too much. I kid.
I can see it now, though. I'm gonna get blasted. People asking me, "Can I read the book?" You know,
it's gonna be the number one thing. The only thing that's gonna be in the comment section. Where can I get this book?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So number one, many claim to be trained by you. Is this true? I haven't seen too many. I'm not in the world in that big circle yet, so I haven't heard this one.
I get people, well, let me put it this way, about two or three times a year, I'll get an email sent to me by one of my assistants or by my case administrator who sends it to me and says, hey, this guy's claiming that he was trained by you. And I'll look at him like, I don't even know who the guy is, right? So a lot of times what people say they're trained is because they actually came and sat in on a conference I gave somewhere. Well, that's not being trained. Trained is you come, you work with me, I give you counsel, I mentor you, etc. That's what being trained is. And not just because you sat through some of my conferences. And so that's what I'm starting to get a little bit here and there. And there's one particular that just came out recently. I'm like, wow, that's pretty bold. I mean, I remember seeing the people, but I don't even remember their names.
I know a guy who sat in a conference. I got trained by him.
Yeah, and recently I recently it was funny because I was told that I was actually consulted for a particular movie that came out, and I'm like, I don't recall this. I went back, I keep every email, every stitch of correspondence. Nothing came up. And then basically later in an interview, the guys that wrote the thing says, well, we didn't actually consult him. We just watched all his videos. Okay, fair enough. You know?
I think of that great movie Spaceballs. I am your father's, brother's, nephew's, cousin's, former roommates.
Yeah, exactly.
What was your input on the new book, The Field Manual by Liber Cristo?
Yeah, that book just came out because there's some question about exactly where the material came from, et cetera. But that book actually just came out from TAN. It's been long in the process. The book was originally, the content was originally kind of put together by my case administrator who works for me, who vets my caseload and who also works with me in doing conferences. But basically what happened is he started putting the work together, and then I went through it, added some stuff, told him reformulate certain things, got that certain things done. And so we basically got this working thing. It wasn't even a really, it was not even written at this point. It was just, this is the stuff that we knew. We had it in bits and pieces here and there. And then we actually talked to Dan Schneider, Dr. Dan Schneider, who did a good job writing it. He then took our stuff and then put it in clear language and put it in a good book format. And so now it's actually being published by TAN. If you look at our protocol, we have four phases of our protocol. This is one of the primary books that we use in phase two. So this is of the protocol. So this is actually something which people can make, use, and get a lot of information on how spiritual warfare works.
And don't worry, ladies and gents, I'll have that below in the show notes. You can get that one. It'll be on the website.
Yeah, and they can also go to Centrad Press and also get my other stuff too if they want.
Yes, yeah, that'll be below it too. So yeah, he's got the Holy Water book. It's not by Father Rip, but it's fantastic. It'll definitely increase your devotion to Holy Water.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when I published that book, when I was reading through it, the one of the principal reasons I wanted to publish that book is because in there the guy actually talks about how you can add water to holy water and still retain its blessing. So, but the other thing was, too, is he talks about how in the early church, they used to have to wash their hands because they would receive communion on the hand. But then later, I'm like, should I take that out? I'm like, no, because that's actually an important historical point. Mm-hmm. The point being is that later the church realized those fonts fell out of use precisely because the church got away from communion in the hand.
Now, it goes back to all these things that people bust their chops about. But I'm reading that book going, there's right there. This other priest from 100 years, 200 years ago saying, refill the water, and it's there.
Yeah, that's one of those books I didn't really talk too much about it publicly, but it's a great little book. And I put it out just so that if people said, where did you get that? I'd say, well, here it is. You know,
it's funny how that works that way.
Yeah, it's funny because people think I literally make stuff up, which is it's just not the case. But anyway,
and then you show it, and you're wrong. It's
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Here's controversial. Are Christian tattoos okay? I'm gonna duck and block right now.
Oh man. Okay. So I was actually. Before my father passed, I was actually working on a book on tattoos. And so now I'm going to put that on hold. And I'm actually going to switch to a book called Shop Talk, which is it's all about the lessons I learned working under my father as a mechanic, because there's enormous amounts of stuff that I learned on a philosophical and theological level, just seeing how practical things work. But anyway, that being said, so I was working on this book because I kind of got concerned at the fact that so many people, even I won't name who it was, but a particular famous priest ended up getting a tattoo, and then he shows it on his podcast and this and that, and he says, you know, the church has never said anything against tattoo. It's actually right in scripture where God says do not tattoo yourself like the pagans. I mean, it's that clear, right? And so then people say, oh well, then Christian tattoos are okay. No, that's not what the issue is. So tattooing, the reason tattooing is immoral is it's the primary reason it's against the first category of natural inclination of the natural law, which is to preserve our being as it is. This is why the moral manuals in the past, they rarely talked about it, because it just simply was not part of the Catholic, the Christian ethos, because it was completely foreign to it. The only people that might get it is like sailors and particularly bad people. And so it was never considered that much of an issue, but it was always considered against the fifth commandment because it was a form of mutilation. So that was it. The content obviously can be offensive to God. It doesn't have to be offensive to God, but quite frankly, people say, well, the Christian tattoo isn't as bad as, actually it's worse, because what you're doing is you're using a Christian symbol in something that's actually a form of, it's sinful, which is mutilation. So it's actually worse. In fact, one of the things I can tell people is so we have to decommission tattoos. And part of that, it basically means, is that as exorcists, we come across people where the demon has a particular attachment to the individual based on the tattoo that the person has. And when you get the demons under duress, they'll actually say things like they consider the tattoo that they convinced the person to get their brand on the individual. This is one of the reasons why we have there's two different rituals you can use. To one can be done by a priest, the other one people can do themselves to decommission tattoos. But the point being is that the worst tattoo I ever had to decommission, It was a tattoo of Saint Michael the Archangel. It was a magnificent tattoo, beautiful tattoo. But the woman, that's the most pain I've ever seen anybody go through in decommissioning that tattoo, that is of Saint Michael. So the fact is that Christian tattoos still fall under that same rubric. It's still a form of mutilation. Historically, it was considered mortal sin, mortally sinful, unless that what they call the parsimoniousness of the matter, which basically just meant like if you had like just like a little dot or something, that would be one thing. But normal tattooing is considered grave matter. So Christian tattoos, because recently I've noticed guys are saying, well, Father Ripper didn't condemn Christian tattoos. First of all, I'm not the guy condemning it. The entire Catholic moral tradition, the entire Old Testament condemned it. So there it is.
I expect the Catechism of Father Hart to come out in the not-so-distant future.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another, I guess, even more controversial. Some have asserted, well, take that back. I'll go to the other one. Recently, some have been criticizing you specifically about Harry Potter. Can't get away from that.
Oh, yeah.
Singling you out. Are you the Lone Ranger? Are you the only one that speaks out against this?
No, I'm the clickbait, I think. And I don't, I'm not trying to say that because I think I have a name or whatever. It basically boils down to people think if they can take me down and my criticisms, then they've actually won the argument, right? And there's two things to this. First of all, I'm not the only guy that's doing it, that has said this. Father Morth, you know, the father of probably the top exorcist in the last 100 years. Although he considers one of his mentors one of the top exorcists in the last 100 years, which could be the case from what I've read about this guy. But you know, so you have Father Morth. Jesse Romero actually compiled a list of all the exorcists that had said there's problems with Harry Potter. So I am by no stretch of the imagination the only guy that says it. The second part of it has to do with this. I'm not saying on this because I don't like Harry Potter, although I have read, I did do some analysis of the writing. I read the first book, etc. It's some of the most pathetic literature I've ever read in my life. I mean, I went through a great books program where I read some of the top literature historically, and this is nowhere near any of that, right? So on a literary level. But that all being said, I found the book extraordinarily boring. But the point being is that, so I don't have any animus personally against it. What I'm talking about is this is what has come up in session. This is what exorcists have had to deal with as a result of people getting involved with Harry Potter. So I'm just telling people, this is what our experience is. If you want to still judge that as not important, it's not just me. It's literally numerous exorcists have had to deal with this. If you want to dismiss that, well, there's nothing I can tell you. All I can tell you is this is what our experience is on the matter.
And that kind of goes into the next one about people getting, I guess, all bent out of shape when you say the demon said this, as in like quoting the demon or saying something that he says factual. I guess I know that he's the father of lies, but he can say some truth. And I actually brought up Father Amorth. It's that book that Tan has. And on page 121 in the chapter, I Am Lucifer, he actually says, I know I shouldn't trust him, but sometimes the devil is unable to lie.
That's right. Yeah. There's two parts to it. Because sometimes people ask you, how do you know that the demon's lying? Well, first of all, they're bad liars. When you deal with them, they're like dealing with a 16-year-old girl who's getting caught in a lie, right? So most of the time you can kind of catch it. Once in a while, though, they're pretty sly, etc. But the other part of it is, too, is that there's two components to it. The first is the church herself requires you to ask questions of the demons. Now, if he's always going to lie and he's never going to tell you the truth and nothing he says you can trust in any way, there's principles that guide when you can tell, no, you can trust him and not. But if you can never, why would the church ever have you ask the questions? There's five questions in the ritual you have to ask. What's your name? How many are there? How did you get in? What's the time and date of departure, etc.? There's literally five set of questions you have to ask him, because you have to get that information sometimes to get him out. And if they never told you the truth, then why would the church in 2,000 years of history in dealing with this stuff tell you that you need to ask these questions? It's right in the rituals themselves. So this is something which is that people have to understand, that there are times that the church herself knows that the demon is going to tell the truth. The demons have the natural law structure in their minds. It's so absolutely clear. And part of that natural law structure is the authority structure. So when the exorcist gives them a command, they know they have to comply. Now they can fight it for a while and they can, but eventually that becomes so overriding in their minds from the faculties and the authority of the church that they're basically compelled to do so. The other thing is too, is that if God gives them, because we see this sometimes in sessions where the demon will be holding out, all of a sudden, boom, his whole demeanor shifts, and then he just tells you straight out, and there's no questioning, there's no nothing. And a lot of times what happens is, because we've beat it out of him, God the Father or God in the background has told him, you have to tell them X. So if God commands them to tell him, they cannot deny his authority in that, because it's so powerful in their mind, they just comply. And so the fact is that there are times which they actually tell the truth. There are principles that we use to determine when they are telling the truth and when they're not. Those principles are pretty consistent. And exorcists, when they become proficient, they can usually fish out pretty quickly when demons are lying and when they're telling the truth. It doesn't mean that they still don't try to lie to you, but there are times when they are compelled and they have no ability. As Morris said, they have to tell the truth. They can't deny their obligation to tell the truth, and they tell you the truth.
In that book, in this book, he brings up that what you just said about the questions, and even he brings this up in, was it page 126? He's talking about when about asking the main questions. If the devil doesn't answer, repeat these questions until he does. But remember that the devil lies. His answers must always be checked. And I assume when you hear something in session, you just don't go run into the podium and say, hey, by the way, double check, you do your due diligence to figure out what he said.
Yeah, well, there's two different kinds of information they're going to give you. The first is about the dynamics of the case. And those you have to base on a couple of principles. The first is, as I mentioned, they're bad liars. But the second one is the principle of coherence. Does what he say fit the dynamics of the case, what you know from the case? Does it fit Catholic theology, right? Does it fit general prudence? So for example, if they say she has to fast on bread and water for a year, yeah, you're lying to me. Because God, the things are normally with liberal people is very simple. It's not stuff that's long drawn out and stuff like that. Okay. So there's that kind of information that deals with the dynamics of the case. But then there are certain times when they're compelled to say certain things about virtues or perfections in regard to Our Lady, the saints, Our Lord, or things about the doctrinal things. And there's principles of that. It's still the principle of coherence. Does it line out with Catholic theology? Could it possibly be the case, you know, or is it likely the case? A lot of times they'll tell you stuff, and then later you'll read it in some father of the church that he had already enunciated that this is actually how this was the case. And so a lot of times they're just telling you stuff that's already available in Catholic theology. But the fact is that when they talk, my experience is when they talk about the virtues and perfections of God, the saints, or Catholic doctrine, or things like that, it's extraordinarily rare that they're going to lie to you, unless they're trying to get you sucked down a rabbit hole where you don't know your theology well. This is one of the things I've seen with some exorcists where they don't know their theology very well. And so as a result, they end up going down rabbit holes. But if you're very strict about following traditional Catholic theology and its principles, then you can use that as the principle, use that and the principle of coherence. And most of the time, they're actually telling you the truth on those things.
Yeah, because he says something about the demon saying he was going to leave on December 8th, and he didn't. And he goes, ... Remember, he's the father of lies, so... I guess theology wise, he can't, you know, you can figure out if he's talking about Mary being humble, that's not exactly being an overstatement.
Yeah, exactly. Or when he talks about, you know, her sense of her love or purity of her love or sacrifice, obviously he's not, what's he got to gain by talking about that type of stuff? But the other part of it is, the leaving, that question, that's probably the one they lie on the most, right? So that's another thing that, you know, just from my experience, you know, they're going to lie. They're likely to lie about this or that. But, and like I said, the principle of coherence is the primary way that you can ferret that stuff out.
Some are outing on social media that you say hardly anyone wants to go to Walmart. Now, why are you picking on a Southern Walmart? I can't believe this. Why? Is it because people are basically crude brutes walking around in Walmart? Did you say this? Now, full disclosure, I jokingly tell people, if you want to feel better about yourself, go to Walmart and you'll come back a lot better.
I have made statements that I can't remember if I've actually made it on any podcast, but I have told in training of exorcists, and I have mentioned to people in public that many of the people that I've worked with, when they go into Walmart, they just shut down. They can't function. Now, I don't know what that means. I have no clue what that means. I don't know if it's the people. I don't know if it's the buildings. I don't know what it is. I'm just pointing that out. But I never did say that, you know, I never used the phrase crude brutes. That's what kind of said, I'm like, really? I've never used that phrase. But basically my point is that I've just had people have difficulty that's going in there. I don't know what it means.
May I ask a bonus question?
Yeah.
The recent events of some exorcist priests that are having fallouts. You can go back even to Father Eitenhower, but the latest one was in Louisiana with that one, the young priest that flew out to, I think, Italy something like this. Is it because you guys are on such like the front line, in a sense, that you got you're dealing with the quote unquote sewer of the spiritual life all the time. You got the kind of like cops. They see the worst of the worst all the time. Is it one of those things that if you're just not in the right, you know, every day pounding away to stay holy, stay in the straight and narrow, that you could fall easier? Is that something like that? Or is this?
There's always two elements that you see exorcists end up imploding. The attrition rate's fairly high, actually. The first is their prayer life is not substantial enough, and their disciplinary life is not same. So they're not fasting and praying sufficiently enough. A lot of times, you know, doing the new rite office and maybe doing a little prayers here and there isn't going to suffice. That's why in our community we pray 3 to 4 hours a day, and even we still get attacked. But because of that prayer life, we're able to sustain them and actually sense them much more quickly and deal with them. And Our Lady protects us a great deal. So it's their prayer life isn't sufficient. That's the primary reason. Then the other reason is they're not following the principles or guidelines that the church has laid out on how they're supposed to proceed. So for example, in one case, it was because basically the guy started doing exorcisms with the women alone. That's a major no-no, right? And so they start fudging on the principles, and then that's when they get taken out. This gentleman that just ran off with the 18-year-old girl, it was just a violation of the Catholic principles and on how all that's supposed to be done. So that's usually the thing. So I always tell guys that I'm training, if you stay in your lane, that is follow the principles, don't go outside, don't do anything outside this, right? Follow this. You know, the biggest mistake is guys want to hurry up the process and get people liberated quickly, so they start doing things that get them into trouble. No, just stay in your lane. And then the other thing is, you really have to beef up your prayer life. You know, if you're not praying a minimum of an hour a day as an exorcist, in addition to your office, I just don't know how you're going to survive it.
I appreciate the clearing up of everything, Padres. Centrad.org. For multimedia, you got the press for the books. Liber Cristo, you have stuff on there as well because you work together with those guys.
Yeah. One thing I could mention is if people are more interested in knowing what these principles are that govern a lot of this stuff. Now, they can actually get the book Dominion, which has a lot of that stuff in, which talks about the prayer life and stuff like that. For priests and healthcare professionals, there's also the book, Nature and Psychology of Diabolic Influence, which is the priest version of that. And that's where I go into, because the chapter in Dominion on Possession is about 80 pages, 75 to 80 pages. In the Diabolic Influence book, it's about 180. So there's a lot more amplification of the principles of what govern that. So stuff is available if they want to go to Centrad Press to get the information.
We appreciate it as always, Father. Can we get a final blessing before you run?
Absolutely. Benedictio Dei omnipotentis, Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sanctus, super vos et manet semper. Amen.
Thank you, Father.